Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fewer and fewer American children wander into the woods to play these days, and that, says our guest tonight, is a problem. For a decade, child advocate and journalist Richard Louvre traveled across the country interviewing children and their parents about their experiences in nature. The story was nearly always the same. Kids were learning about the Amazon rainforest, but were losing touch with the nature right around them. The park, the creek, the field, the woods. Richard Louvre sees a nature deficit disorder at work. Tonight on Point, a generation of American children cut off from nature and what it might take to bring them back. But first, we begin tonight in Lebanon, where an alliance of the country's two main Shiite parties, Hezbollah and Amal, swept the country's second round of regional parliamentary elections, this time in the south, on the border with Israel. Nicholas Blandford is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him to interpret Hezbollah's strong showing.
Well, there was never any doubt about it. Hezbollah entered into an electoral alliance with the traditional rival for the Shia vote, which is called the Amal movement. These two parties, Hezbollah and Amal, dominate the Shia community politically in Lebanon. And the moment they formed an alliance, which they announced a couple of months ago, it was clear that they were going to sweep the board, and indeed they did, securing all 23 seats.
Now, this is in the hilly southern region along the Israeli border. Remind us how this vote fits into the national picture of voting that's unfolding in Lebanon.
Well, in a way, this round of voting was a bit of an anomaly because, in general terms, the opposition are expecting to fare very well throughout the five voting districts. Hezbollah and Amal are, or were, I should say, staunch pro-Syrian parties. They are amending their position somewhat to take into account the fact that the Syrians are no longer calling the shots in Lebanon. And a few opposition candidates that were running in the southern round really didn't stand a chance. Indeed, in many places, the opposition didn't field any candidates at all, knowing full well that Hezbollah and Amal were going to sweep the board.
Now, as you say, this is just one round in the voting that will ultimately be national. In Beirut, the so-called opposition, which is headed by the son of Rafik Hariri, who was assassinated some weeks ago, has done very well and is expected to dominate nationally. So by opposition, you mean opposition to the current regime, which had been close to Syria. Am I right?
That's right. Well, I guess we're in a sort of a flux, really, at the moment. We've been referring to the opposition as the opposition to the pro-Syrian government in Lebanon. But in not too short a period of time, of course, the opposition are going to form the next government. They're going to have the majority in the 128-seat parliament. Saad Hariri, the son of Rafik Hariri, is estimating that the opposition will gain between 80 and 90 seats in that 128-seat parliament. And he is touted as the most likely choice to become the next prime minister.
Nick, what does this victory of the Shiites, the Hezbollah and Amal in the south, mean for the central government and for Lebanon overall? Is there a risk of it returning to the kind of sectarian strife that plagued it for so many years?
Lebanon is a very sectarian country, and you can't really get away from that. But is this going to turn into civil war? I don't think so. I think the various catalysts that sparked the civil war back in 1975 are no longer relevant. It's going to be a rather complicated period of time, a rather fraught period of time as well. One of the most pressing issues that the new government is going to have to deal with once the elections are over is the issue of disarming Hezbollah. Hezbollah is subject to a UN Security Council resolution at the moment, which calls for the dismantling of Hezbollah's military wing. But one thing for certain is that Hezbollah's emphatic victory yesterday showed that they do have a very high level of support, and it's really not going to be a question of the government simply standing up and saying, okay, your fun is over, Hezbollah, you're going to have to turn in your weapons and become a purely political party.
What are the implications for Israel of Hezbollah's strong victory in the south and for Lebanese-Israeli relations?
I don't think we're going to see any major difference to the status quo that has existed down there for almost 5 years now. But we'll see continued tension. But Hezbollah is very aware of the general mood in Lebanon. It knows that they can't just launch attacks without taking into account the mood of its electorate and the mood of the Lebanese in general. Of course, the Lebanese don't want a war with Israel. It's still a very tense situation, and one can never guarantee 100% certainty that everything is going to be okay. But I don't think either side, either the Israelis or Hezbollah, are intent on seriously destabilizing the situation.
Overall, does this leave Lebanon on its path of opposition to Syrian influence, on its path of reform, Nick?
Well, this is a big question. Many Lebanese have been rather disappointed with the way that these elections have unfurled, particularly given the very heady atmosphere in the wake of the assassination of Rafi Hariri, when there was a genuine sense, I think, of national unity. You're seeing these unprecedented demonstrations of hundreds of thousands of people gathering in central Beirut, calling for the Syrians to leave. But the Lebanese have been rather disappointed that we're going to see many of the same old faces appearing again in Parliament. The electoral process, the run-up to the polls, were filled with the usual political intrigue, alliances being struck, basically ensuring that the political elite, for the most part, are going to return to Parliament. Maybe 10% of Parliament will change, but the other 90% really isn't going to change at all.
And there will be Hezbollah right in the middle of that. Nicholas Blandford, thanks very much for joining us.
Sure, you're welcome.
Nicholas Blandford covers Lebanon for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Damascus, Syria. The onset of the lazy days of summer once meant kids building tree houses and exploring the woods, hiding in grassy meadows and wading in shallow streams. Then, says my guest tonight, the age of high tech and fear fenced American children in, into the safety of organized sports, into the shuttered world of TV rooms and video games. Richard Louvre says American children are now suffering from a nature deficit disorder and that it's taking a toll on their bodies and souls. Tonight on Point, American children cut off from nature and the great outdoors. You can join the conversation. Do you see it? A generation of children suffering from nature deficit disorder. What's the reason? What's the cost? And what's the solution? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Diego, California, is Richard Louvre, columnist for the San Diego Union-Tribune and author of 7 books about family, nature, and community. His new book is Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Richard Louvre, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly and natural-born woodsman. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
We'll see. Richard Louvre, nature deficit disorder, what is it? What are you talking about?
Well, first, I'm very careful not to say that that is some kind of known clinical diagnosis. I think of that as a way of thinking about the price that kids pay and, that, in fact, that we all pay for being alienated from nature.
Some poetic license here, then. But what's the poetry of deprivation you're describing?
Well, I like to think about it in terms of the recent research that shows what kids get from nature. I mean, this is quite recent. We've just ignored this in the academic world. You know, has studied just about everything that affects child development except this one. And this is the elephant in the room. But this recent body of knowledge is fascinating. I mean, it shows, dramatic decreases in stress for kids when they have direct contact with nature, ADHD or attention deficit disorders. Great studies at the University of Illinois showing that the symptoms of ADHD decrease with any kind of direct contact with nature. In education, there's fascinating studies, again, that show the increased cognitive functioning, even increased grades, even increased scores on standardized testing when you have an emphasis on outdoor classrooms. So when you think about all of that, all the good that nature gives kids, then you have to wonder what happens when they don't get much nature.
And you're saying essentially what you describe as nature deficit disorder, not a clinical term, we understand that, but you're saying it's just the opposite, more stress, more ADHD, you even say more obesity, more depression.
I think so. I mean, the way the studies are done, they don't ask it that way. You know, they don't ask what is happening to the whole population. They just look mainly at the improvements that happen when kids have nature. But I've turned that around in this book and asked the larger question, I think, which is what happens when a generation loses its connection, much of it, that generation loses its connection to nature, and then what happens when that divide grows over the future generations? And I should add here that, you know, this doesn't affect all kids. I mean, some families have really worked hard to get their kids out into nature. They've been doing the right things, often, as I did as a father, out of instinct or nostalgia. But now this body of knowledge is there that I think would suggest that getting kids into nature is not an extracurricular activity or nice to have. It's probably very, very important to healthy childhood development.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Richard Louv paints a kind of picture of American children being sort of like Huck Finns or Walt Whitmans thrown into a room with a television and a Nintendo set and locked in there and suffering.
Suffering and missing something basic. Kant called it the sublime, the feeling we can only get when confronted with vast displays of nature, the crashing ocean, the mountain crag, the waterfall, something that so encompasses and floods our reason that we're almost in a state of shock by it. That feeling of terror and beauty and vastness all combined make for the sublime, and it can only, it's one of the most extraordinary things on the planet, and you can only have it when confronted with nature. And to lose that, not to have that experience somewhere in your psychic background, that is indeed a poverty.
We're going into the woods to see who's there and who's not tonight with Richard Louv. His new book is Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. You can join us. What do you think? Do you buy that American kids are suffering from that deficit? Are your kids cut off from nature, from lazy days of tadpoles and mud and playing in the woods, the fields, the bushes? We're 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about American kids cut off from nature, plugged into the video screen, the soccer field, and fear. My guest tonight is Richard Louv. He's a columnist for the San Diego Union-Tribune and author of the new book, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. You can join us. What do you think? Do you see a nature deficit disorder in America's children? Are we afraid to let our children roam untethered into nature? Why? And what's lost when children don't get down and dirty and lost in nature? Are terrariums and gerbils and the Nature Channel a substitute for that mud between the toes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Richard Louv, describe sort of where American children were and where they are today in your research. I mean, is there a, you know, mythologizing the past? Was it really the kind of Huck Finn lazing down the river? Or is it really so far from that image today?
Well, first, I don't remember the name of your other guest.
Jack Beatty's with us, yes.
Well, I wanted to compliment him. He said that better than I did. The sublime, that's a wonderful way to put it. And I often use the word wonder. I mean, it's tough to get a sense of wonder playing Grand Theft Auto on the Nintendo. In terms of what's different, I'm careful in the book not to trash technology. I'm not saying that computers are bad and that kids use, you know, that that's a waste of time for kids. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that there's a sense of balance that's been lost. In terms of how it's changed, we don't know for certain exactly what has changed in terms of counting it. I mean, the longitudinal studies haven't been done to compare the 50s or the 60s with today. There have been some studies that show that, for instance, between 1970 and 1990, the radius around the home where kids were allowed to roam, nine-year-olds on their own, had shrunk to a ninth of what it had been in 1970.
In other words, they had 10 times as much room to roam or permission to roam 25 years ago or 35 years ago.
That's right. Meanwhile, they have unlimited area to roam in cyberspace. So that's a very different relationship. When I was a kid, I had really a very personal relationship with my woods and my fields, and I pulled out hundreds of survey stakes, I think, that I knew had something to do with the bulldozers that were taking out other woods. I mean, they were mine. But I couldn't have told you anything about the Amazon rainforest. You know, kids today can tell you anything about the Amazon rainforest. They can, very few of them can tell you about the last time they went out and had a sense of wonder under the trees.
And you're saying there's a real, not just experiential cost, but a kind of psychological cost to that. How do you define it?
I think that sense is sublime, the lost sense of wonder. And what replaces it, I mean, D.H. Lawrence, I have this quote from a great essay he did in the 1920s describing what New Mexico did for him. And essentially he said he lost his know-it-all state of mind, as he put it.
Mm.
And whenever he traveled after that, he saw below the surface, beneath the surface, in ways that he hadn't. And nature in New Mexico did that for him. That's that essence of the sublime. There's a chapter late in the book, I often don't talk about it because people get nervous, but it's called The Spiritual Necessity of Nature for Children. And I don't talk about that in a denominational way or anything like that. And I don't talk about worshiping nature. But I do say that how can we get a sense of wonder? How can children get a full sense of wonder if we have denied them, if they're under house arrest and playing Grand Theft Auto?
What's the house arrest you talk about? What do you mean by that?
Well, we are very, very afraid. I mean, and I have to say that as a parent, I felt that fear. My boys are 17 and 23 now, and I certainly felt that fear. They didn't have the kind of freedom that I had as a kid. And I'm not advocating going back to the 50s, although in some cases that might work. I am saying that we need to be much more intentional about getting our kids engaged in nature.
Yeah, but intentionality also seems to be something of what you're criticizing here, that everything's packaged and planned and structured, and you just want the kids out there. You write about the criminalization of natural play. What do you mean by that?
Well, first, believe me, I know that paradox of, you know, organized, unorganized activity in nature. I understand that paradox, and I struggle with it throughout the book, and there are ways to deal with that, I think, through somewhat structured activities. But in terms of the criminalization of natural play, early in Last Child in the Woods, there's a chapter called that. And basically, I looked at, you know, if you count up all the federal laws and state laws and local laws, add to that the well-meaning and necessary environmental restrictions, and then add to that the covenants and restrictions, the CC&Rs that govern almost every new development, housing development built in the last 20 years, and you come to the conclusion that playing outdoors is illegal for kids. I mean, in my neighborhood, the community association has gone around tearing down tree houses and forts in the canyons of our neighborhoods. I talked to a woman the other day who said that her community association had outlawed drawing with chalk drawing that children do on sidewalks. It's not as if all of those laws and regulations are enforced. They're not. But the message gets through to kids, and kids are getting this meta message from society right now, and they're doing what we tell them to. It doesn't matter what words come out of our mouths. What they're hearing from us is that nature's in the past, probably doesn't count anymore, electronics is the future, and the boogeyman lives in the woods. And they're doing what we ask them to do when they sit in front of that computer game for hours at a time.
Well, it's an amazing picture, Jack Beatty, that Richard Louv paints here. I mean, on the one hand, I think we all pretty much know exactly what he's talking about. On the other, when you think about how quickly things have changed, I think, I mean, my own childhood was maybe unusual. It was deep in a farm and deep in the boondocks and very happy there in the creeks and fields and woods. But I can't imagine childhood without that, yet that's what we hand most of our children today.
Yes, and when we do, well, Wordsworth was very conscious of this, and his poetry really is all about the growth of a child's imagination in nature. And he was terribly afraid, and what struck him again and again was how, as adults, we enter a kind of prison house, and we lose the wonder, the perceptions we had as a child. He writes in Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood, "There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth, and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now as it hath been of yore. Turn wheresoe'er I may, by night or day, the things which I have seen I now can see no more." That the child sees things, something that holds him in life, and that he can repair, he or she can nurture him. What he experiences is the authentic. And this is a world in conspiracy against the experience of the authentic. And in a way, what's happened to us is that we're like our children are more like Wordsworth's man who asks, where is it now, the visionary gleam? Where has it gone, the glory and the dream?
The sort of prematurely aged the children,
yes,
today, away,
yeah,
from that, or maybe never having touched it. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Jerry's calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. Great show. I love this topic tonight.
Oh, good.
I think that, first of all, I'm a kid who grew up with lots of forts and lots of adventure, and I ended up building my own house in the woods.
You're still building forts then?
Still building forts, and now you can get a home equity loan on
them. Right. Great, good for you. What about your kids?
Well, my kids, you know, my wife and I had to make critical decisions when we decided to be parents to not include television and computers in our home. They have access to them, like at the library or at Grandma and Grandpa's house.
Yep.
But if you don't put those things in your home, they go out and build tree forts.
How old are your children now, Jerry?
9 and 11.
And are they rebelling yet? Are they smuggling their iPod in?
No. They don't even have one yet. But they, you know, they know that we have made certain decisions that aren't in the mainstream. But they know that it's also freed them up to have a wigwam in the woods and have two different tree forts. And they've given them names and they sleep out in them. And they get to do those types of things that they know other kids just don't even, you know, desire to do because they haven't even been opened up to that world.
Amen, and I'm all for it, but explain to us how you see what they will take forward into their adult life here, and maybe in opposition to what they might take from, Nintendo and being online a lot.
Well, I think the thing that I think is most critical is it can't just happen in the summer. It's a year-round thing because nature doesn't happen just in summer. So they'll know when the spring peepers come and what they are. They'll know when the mushrooms come and they gather them. They know when maple syrup runs. It runs in the spring. They know how to make snow forts. They know, you know, they know the seasons. They know the various things that nature can give them, and not have it being an isolated, you know, thing that they, you know, see on their computer screen. It'll be something real and something meaningful to them beyond someone telling them how to experience nature. They will have experienced it and hopefully carry that with them for the rest of their life.
Wow, there is one fully conscious parent, Jerry, doing it for his children. Richard Louv, there's a family committed to make happen what you say is lost for most. You see different children coming out of that experience.
Well, and those parents are out there. I'm hearing from a lot of them, and they have made brave decisions. I'm not quite as brave as your caller. I mean, there's still a Nintendo game in our house, but you know, we've tried to find a sense of balance with all of that. But I think he was very eloquent in what he described. A lot of parents, again, are out there doing the right thing, but you know, they don't know about this body of knowledge that has not been really reported in one place between two covers until now. And what I'm hearing from parents like that is a sense of relief and affirmation that this is why, you know, I got one email, so the subject line was, now I know what I'm doing, why I'm doing what I'm doing, and that it's right.
But an awful lot of people don't do it. You write that one of the things that cuts parents off from letting their children roam in that natural world is fear, the sort of stranger danger, the boogeyman, as you describe it. What's going on there?
I've been reporting on that phenomenon ever since Childhood's Future, which I wrote 15 years ago, and it's a strange thing. I mean, when you look at the statistics, it doesn't add up. I mean, there's a 2005 Duke University Child Well-Being Index that came out this year, and it says American kids are safer now than they've been any time since 1975. The actual incidences of stranger abductions has been going down, not up. But what has been going up is the CNN and MSNBC and the 24-hour news cycle in which a few cases, you know, maybe 5 or 7 cases a year get put on an endless loop, and they're played over and over and over again. And when they get done playing that, then they play the trial, and then they run the ribbon underneath the images.
So the world seems more dangerous than it in fact is.
Absolutely. I mean, if we watch that stuff, we, of course, there are child abductors behind our house at this very moment.
Pounding on every window, but yeah. Then, in fact, there aren't. Kelly's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Kelly. You're on the air.
Hi. I love this topic. This is great.
What do you think? What do you see, Kelly?
Well, what I see is that I grew up in Colorado, and I did have that kind of childhood where you could, you know, run through the backyard and have it never end and be on a farm with animals and just be at peace in nature. And I think I took it for granted in my adult life that would be there for my kid. And I think what I decided as a single mom is that my child could get that through school, through alternative school in Chapel Hill.
How's that worked out?
It's worked out great. The school is, can I say the name?
Sure.
It's Community Independent School in Pittsburgh, just outside of Chapel Hill.
But how does it work? Is it out in the middle of the woods? Do the kids have more interaction with nature than an ordinary school?
Oh, definitely. The campus is actually based on the outdoor part of campus. It has a large garden and goats and chickens and huge, you know, 50-acre area where the kids can go through paths and walk, and they have a full-time nature instructor that actually does outdoor science with all the kids.
Wow, lucky for your children, but of course most children the school is not like that.
Well, it's true. I mean, he's got an option of going to kindergarten next year, and checking out the public school, they have a great outdoor, climbing area, absolutely no trees, no shade. It has, you know, a great activity area, but it's not really nature. It's just things to climb on.
It's outdoors, but kind of sanitized. Kelly, it sounds like you're on a lucky track right now, and thanks for your call. I want to bring another voice into our conversation to respond on just this point. David Sobel is joining us from Wellfleet, Massachusetts. He's director of integrated learning programs at Antioch New England Graduate School. He's author of Beyond Ecophobia, Reclaiming the Heart in Nature Education. David Sobel, thanks for joining us tonight.
It's great to be here.
So what do you see going on in schools, and can schools, Kelly's found a school in North Carolina that lets her five-year-old, run through nature and be right next to it. How are schools doing in general when it comes to getting kids close to nature?
You know, there's two opposite trends going on, and one is the sanitized nature trend with more and more fear and anxiety and less kids climbing trees and being able to be in the woods. And then there's other schools that are doing what gets referred to as place-based education that are trying to really use the schoolyard and the community as the context for learning. So you got both things happening.
And we read from Richard Louv talking about how nature's become a more abstract notion. Kids learning about the Amazon rainforest, but not about the forest that's in walking distance of their own home. What kind of adults are we raising when children have this kind of abstract, high concept notion of nature?
Yeah, I think you wind up with adults who don't really have a sense that they can do anything about local environmental problems or local democratic processes. So I think that when kids have the opportunity to be in the natural world and shape it, it gives them that sense of agency that they carry on into community life later on. So I think you get a sense of alienation that is not just from nature, but from a lot of social processes.
I wonder still, there's so many ways to thrive. As romantic as the vision is, as wonderful as it may be, let's get to the call. Janet's calling from Manhattan in New York. Hi, Janet, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just think this is a case where, we're looking for things to worry about. I mean, my kids, I have two kids, we live in Manhattan, and their nature is exploring the city. And I let them go on their own. They've been taking the subway since they're 7 years old.
The world's biggest monkey bars there.
Yeah, what was that?
The world's biggest monkey bars. They got all of Manhattan.
That's right. And I've got to say that as a family, once a year, we do, they were just in the Amazon in Brazil in the break, and they didn't have a lack of sense of wonderment.
It just came immediately to them, you're seeing.
Yes, it did. And, they learn about nature in school, and they enjoy it when they're in it. And, they have, I think that they're thriving. It's about the child, and it's about the family. If they're curious, I don't think we're going to have problems later on,
Janet, stick with me for a second here. Richard Louv, how about it? Children have grown up in cities for an awfully long time and lived very productive lives. So Janet says, why not?
Right, and I understand what she's saying. I actually make the case in the book that New York City has more nature in it than many suburbs in the United States today, that there's a lot of opportunity. My older son lives in New York now, and my younger son and I fish, and my older son and I walk. And every time I visit New York, we go on these long walks. We walk for 5.5 hours one day just in Central Park. So there is a lot of kind of organic aspect to the older cities. The newer ones really are where the bigger problem is. And your caller is right. You don't have to live next to Yosemite to have a sense of nature and to have engagement in nature. It does depend on the family and the kid. But most kids aren't as lucky as the kids in this family.
Janet, thanks very much for your call from Manhattan. David Sobel, a final thought from you. Where do you see this headed? Are schools going to pick up the slack, or is it up to individual families, communities?
I think both. I think it's great if families need to do it, and I think schools will respond to parental desire to have their kids out in the community and doing, you know, doing real world stuff. We've got kids, you know, developing trail guides for their towns and doing civic improvement and you know, restoring wetlands and things like that. And I think parents see that that stuff really makes a difference in kids' educations and will advocate for it.
David Sobel, author of Beyond Ecophobia, thanks a lot for being with us tonight. Richard Louv, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're talking about American kids cut off from nature. What do you think? Is this sense of loss a romantic illusion? Or are kids cut off from nature and missing something vital? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Richard Louv. He's author of the new book, Last Child in the Woods, Saving Our Children from Nature Deficit Disorder. Jack Beatty's with us as well. You can join us. What's your antidote to nature deficit disorder? And is a child of nature more at home in the world, less alienated? Or is the Nintendo whiz more suited for the world as it is and likely will be? What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How do you see your children and nature? Sandy's calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Sandy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I love the show, and I just want to say that I think a lot of it has to do with both parents working. It seems as if neighborhoods, there's no one left in the neighborhoods. They're just quiet during the day. The children come home from school, and basically we use computers as babysitting tools, as they used to maybe 10 years ago use TV sets. And it seems as if the kids just don't have time to go out and play, or there's no one around even to watch over them, say, to go out and play.
But, Sandy, why not use, I don't know, the creek down at the end of the road instead of the computer or television? Why not use the pond? Why not use a field? If children have time, time to kill even, why not do it outside?
I think we're so afraid. The kids come home from school and we basically are locking them in until we as parents come home from work, because we want to know where they are.
Yeah.
Even as far as you know, after school activities, dance in school or whatever, we might have one parent maybe that would drive the kids somewhere or something on that idea, but basically they're home in the house after school,
kind of in the safe zone there, and not in trouble. I think you put your finger right on it, Sandy. Thanks for your call. Richard Louv, I mean, Sandy points to, you know, the whole kind of matrix that makes this happen. It's not just one piece or another, but parents maybe both working. They're not sure anyone's going to be in the neighborhood to watch out for the kids. There's a whole kind of community structure that is, it seems, discouraging people from saying, hey, just get out there and play.
And she's right, and you're right that it's a matrix. It's no one thing. I've been writing about the unraveling of that web for about 15 years. You know, kids do like to have their solitude, but they like to have somebody watching. I want to make clear, though, that this isn't hopeless. At least half of the book deals with what people can do in their own families, but what schools can do, what urban planners can do. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening out there. Just with, for instance, a couple of moments when I began to get very hopeful writing the book was, one of them was when I began to learn more about green urbanism, particularly in Western Europe. I mean, whole different kinds of towns and cities where they're erasing the line between what is urban and what is natural and bringing nature into the neighborhoods in an organized way. But the other moment was when I started interviewing college kids, and I thought that I would, you know, be rejected or they'd be defensive, because essentially these were the first denatured generation, in a sense.
Ouch, who wants to be called that? Yeah.
Well, I didn't call them that. But,
nevertheless.
But I, you know, I started telling them what I was learning, and the exact opposite happened. They were on the edge of their seats. They said, you know, now that you're saying this, you're right, and that's us, and we're missing out on something. We had enough, just a taste enough of nature that we know we've been missing something, and now that you've pointed it out, that elephant in the room, we see it. They started sending me email and essays, the college students did, and there were kind of two themes. One was they were not going to do that to their kids once they started thinking about it. The other theme was they asked, how can they apply what they're learning in college now, the profession they're choosing, to healing that broken bond between children and nature in the future? And I cannot think of a single profession or job that can't be applied in part or in full, whether you're a teacher, a custodian, or a physician, or an urban planner. There's a lot that we can do. And I think there's a sense of excitement among those people who see this. And strangely enough, this is one of those issues we can do something about. We may not be able to bring peace to Lebanon, but we can do this in our neighborhoods and in our schools.
Jack Beatty, here we're looking at kind of market forces, employment patterns, family structure, each in their own way, tending lately to pull kids away from nature. Richard Liu says it can be turned around. He says he's got a generation, the denatured generation, determined to do that, but it's not easy if it's kind of uphill against the way your suburb is laid out.
Well, that's it. Your suburb is laid out. When you talk to people from the far west, what a different picture you get. I talked to a guy in Centennial, Wyoming, population 100, who when he was 12 or 13 was up with the cattle somewhere on the hill, and he became aware that a puma, a big cat, was stalking not the herd, but him. And
there's a lesson.
And the cat was between where he was and his rifle and his little camp. And he spent the afternoon circling around that cat and getting to his rifle and then scaring it away. And he said that was the basis of all his confidence in life, challenging this wild and really dangerous, having this dangerous experience of nature and coming out on the other side. Now, you can't have that in a suburb, that's for sure.
Well, there's a sense of groundedness that comes. Richard Liu, what do you think?
Well, it's a great story, and there's a similar one in Last Child in the Woods. It's a former editor of mine who lives in a suburb, but he takes his kid out to the mountains near San Diego, and they were hiking one day, and they saw mountain lion tracks. They crossed the tracks, kept going. On the way back, they saw another set of tracks, and he suddenly realized they were being circled by a mountain lion. They got back to the car, he and his son, and they're sitting there. And my friend, the editor, said that was the first time in years he could remember using all of his senses at the same time. And that's one of the keys for why nature is so good for kids and for all of us. It's, you know, other than a New York subway, perhaps, it's the only time that we use all of our senses at the same time. We're firing on all cylinders. I think that explains a lot about the attention, you know, the improvement in attention, the cognitive improvement. It explains just a lot about what nature gives kids and gives all of us if we give it a chance.
It is utterly absorbing. Bill's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello. This is fantastic. You really caught my attention with this one because I grew up out in the woods, practically. I considered it my home. I grew up on a farm in southeastern Minnesota, and I was fortunate to have a lot of woodland to be my second home.
Yeah.
And I remember I must have given my parents heart attacks more than once because I would be out wandering in the woods in the dead of winter, snow up to my knees, a full moon sparkling on the snow in the dead silence that you find out there.
Yes.
Nothing moves you more than the sudden bark of a fox in the distance on a night like that. And you just stand still and you feel a spirit that you'll never feel anywhere else except when you're out in nature. A spiritual thing is being lost as a whole by our society by not experiencing those kinds of things, whether it's summertime laying out in a clover field and watching the butterflies flutter around you, or whether it's wintertime hiking out in the woods in knee-deep snow. You miss it. You miss a touch of the divine, and thus the spirituality that is so important to gaining wisdom in your life if you don't have that.
Bill, well said. Well said. Who can't hear that and relate to it? You're kind of singing the song of my youth there, and you pull me back to it. Richard Liu, I mean, I've had transcendent experiences in urban settings, but I'd have to say my first ones, maybe just because that's where I was, but they came in nature, that sense of being overwhelmed, overawed, even ecstatic, even in that kind of setting. Hard to reproduce, maybe, in a nicely mowed patch of lawn.
I think so. And we can have those kind of experiences in urban areas. It's true. It's not black and white, but certainly it's more available in that kind of setting. Something that Jack said about the sense of mastery. I speculate, and it is speculation in Last Child in the Woods, that kids that have this kind of experience in nature actually will be safer later on because their senses are more finely tuned. You know, they'll know if somebody's walking behind them if they have those senses working, and that's what nature does, one of the many things it does for us. There's something about that transcendent experience. I can't remember whether I said this or not, but studies have been done of environmentalists and conservationists and where they got that spark. And almost without exception, they had those kinds of transcendent experiences in nature. So, you know, people like to diminutize this issue. They like to pat it on its head and say, well, it's just a children's issue. Let me tell you, what happens if future generations continue to split away from that direct experience of nature? Where do future stewards of the earth come from? This has everything to do with the actual future of nature.
Jack, I find myself both really relating to the reminiscences of everyone offering tonight of childhoods in nature. On the other hand, we know what's happening on this planet. The population is still going up. It may go down at some point, but it's still going up. More and more mega cities. I mean, this is the world we live in now for many people. It's not a Minnesota woods. And yet, human beings, we like to think of them as almost infinitely adaptable. So, crisis or just a moment of evolution here?
I suppose a moment of evolution. I think Sandy and Richard are absolutely right that those experiences in the Minnesota woods, the bark of that fox, that cold night, the nip at your nose, the feeling of, you know, the rain crashing, those things immunize you in this world of the city. They not only put your senses on notice, but they give you a kind of, you know, emotional sheath. You've had an experience of wholeness and something beyond your comprehension, and what does Wordsworth say? He said, "Those shadowy recollections, which be they what they may, are yet the fountain light of all our day, and yet are yet a master light of all our seeing."
Wow. Richard Louv, speak to the child who grows up in one of the mega cities of this century. Just got a minute here, but the child growing up in the midst of a city of 10 million people, what's your advice? What's the path?
I remain very hopeful, partly because of what I'm hearing from people around the country as on the book tour. There's much that we can do, and the book talks about a lot of that. And it's never too late. You know, in terms of the kids growing up in those kind of cities, I tell the story of watching some kids in the Job Corps who were taken out to a nature preserve near where I live in San Diego, and I spent the day with them. These are gang members. And one of them said, "It's too loud out here." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "All these sounds." And it turned out that these sounds he'd never heard, and they seemed to have meaning, even though he'd grown up with, you know, gunshots. But as the day went by, these young guys, that flat affect disappeared, the cynicism fell from their eyes, and they became 8-year-olds by the time the sun set, and they were jumping over creeks. They'd become someone else.
It's a beautiful image. Never too late, I guess, what we hear right there. Richard Louv, the book is Last Child in the Woods. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Jack, thank you very much for joining us, my friend.
I'm going to put my tent in the woods tonight.
All right. We'll look for you. Listen for the bark of the fox, Jack. In a moment, author Barbara Kingsolver's advice to the class of 2005. This is On Point. For those who are graduating from college this spring, the biggest source of stress can be finding that first job. Author Barbara Kingsolver's advice to the class of 2005, don't choose a career based on salary. Choose one that will leave a positive impact on the world, she says. America's become a nation that borrows more than it saves, says Barbara Kingsolver, a nation that consumes more than it produces, that takes more than it gives. Throughout this spring, we've been bringing you notable commencement addresses from across the country. Here's Barbara Kingsolver speaking at Center College in Danville, Kentucky.
You can't possibly hold the delusions that the rest of us have long held dear. America the great, the beloved, the people everybody else wants to be. Our parents used to tell us that's who we were, and we really wanted to believe it. And we can't tell you that, because you'd laugh. You know we are a nation great, and we are a nation dreadful, a mixed blessing on the face of the globe. You know that some people want to be like us, and some don't. And that many are not happy with what we do, with what we use up, what we send out into the world, our pollution, our armies, our sense of what belongs to us. You know that we have refused to cooperate in the global community in many important ways, that we've scorned the world court, that we've refused to sign the Kyoto Protocol, the first international agreement to curb air pollution and global warming. We have created ourselves in an image that is powerful, to be sure, but not universally held to be glorious. That's the America you get. One that's riddled with promises and debts and good intentions gone wrong. You get to see if you can do it better. I suspect you will. And I believe this mainly because you don't have a choice. You don't get to live on delusions while you use up your kids' inheritance of wilderness and goodwill. That money is spent. As you make your choices about what to do with your life, you will make them in a new context of scarcity. The fuel you get to use, the trees you get to cut down, limited. The food, not enough to go around. The markets you can develop, the allies you can rely on, the goodwill you may squander through careless mistakes, it's all limited. And you know it. That's what's new. Here's the deal. Scarcity is the mother of morality. The choices you make about what you will produce and what you will consume will be moral choices in a new way that they were not 100 years ago or even 10 years ago. It's not the first time people have attached some moral value to their professions and their consumption, but it's the first time we really need to do that every day in terms of the things that we use in a daily way, to measure what we could gobble up against what we really need, to pursue work that will lead to more equitable distributions, more sustainable consumption, for the sake of peace in the present and survival in the future. It's not something we even thought of in the past. But when scarcity becomes as clear as it must be to you, it can shock us or inspire us to think twice about what we take.
Author Barbara Kingsolver speaking at the commencement exercises of Center College in Danville, Kentucky. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.